And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usery, and it's my honor to welcome Robert Olin Butler back to the program today. Bob is one of America's most acclaimed writers of fiction, having not only won many literary honors, including the Pulitzer Prize, but he has also had a prize for short fiction named in his honor. Early in his writing career, Butler wrote fiction about the Vietnam conflict from several different angles. And in his latest novel, Perfume River, he looks at how this war, and even wars before and since, have influenced the Quinlan family. Perfume River begins with Robert Quinlan and Darla, a couple of married professors in their late 60s, early 70s, having dinner at a natural foods co-op in Tallahassee, Florida. Robert spots a disheveled man who he takes to be a veteran of the Vietnam War. Why is his eye drawn to this man?
Well, at first glance, and of course he's umbered by street life and perhaps giving off an impression that ultimately is a mistaken one slightly. Just at first glance, Robert sees him as a vet. And it's not just external things. Robert, as is his father and as are other characters in the book, Robert has a kind of ongoing internal dialogue between the past and the present. And he's 70. This is the present day. It's my boomer generation. And what's in his past that continues to talk to him is Vietnam. And so I think all of that makes him look at this man and see him in a way that he soon corrects for himself, but he sees him as a Vietnam vet initially.
It's been a while since you've written about Vietnam in a novel or full collection. Why did it come back to you at this time as a topic?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think I may have, last time we talked, I may have cited something that Graham Greene once said, a great British novelist. He said that all good novelists have bad memories. He says, what you remember comes out as journalism. What you forget goes into the compost of the imagination. And I think that's deeply true of my process and the process of other literary artists. I think in some ways, I haven't come back to it. It's the compost has finally prepared it for me. I think in some ways, I've been working on this book in that composted way. I've been working on this book for at least 60 of my 71 years. The factors, because it's not just about Vietnam, it's about family, it's about the secrets we keep, it's about the frailty of language and human communication, it's about so many things that get all drawn together in the circumstances of this book. You know, it's not a flashpoint, it was a long accumulation of life in me and the composting of it, so that finally this object emerged, that is the novel.
And it's been composting for Robert Quinlan in the novel.
Oh, it has.
Because he went to Vietnam. He pretty much designed his own gig to be over there. And so his family thinks that he had a fairly easy time of it while in country there.
Well, yeah, certainly his father does. And it is true, easy is a relative thing, needless to say, in Vietnam. There were no front lines. But there's a reality of warfare behind that. Escapes most people's notice that, and this is true of the Vietnam War and these numbers, and I think the numbers are pretty much the same for all wars, that fewer than 20% of the people who go to war ever see combat in whatever classic way it attends to that war. And Robert ends up in one of those kinds of jobs. There was an opportunity during the draft to enlist for a third year, and if you qualified by tests and so forth, to choose your military occupational specialty. So that option, you know, they made no full guarantees. It was the next thing to it for that third year of enlistment. So a lot of people were able to do that.
And also back in that time in early 68, Johnson had ended the graduate student deferment, and his brother Jimmy was in college, and he didn't have the same attitudes toward the war as his other family did.
No. I mean, Robert tried to, in volunteering for the Army and in going to Vietnam, he thought without considering what sort of job he'd do there as also a factor, but in terms of those two things, he thought he would finally earn the thing he's yearned for all his life, which was the love and respect of his father. It was a very difficult, not very, but a classically difficult, uncommunicative man and a World War II veteran himself. Jimmy, 2 years younger than Robert, has the same father and the same challenge. And at the point where his number comes up in terms of Vietnam, he has a girlfriend who later becomes his wife in the anti-war movement. And he takes a different path in regards to the war and underneath it in regards to his father. And he exiles himself. He goes to Canada. And when the book begins, which is present day, Jimmy has not seen anyone in his family for 45 years. But in the book, William breaks his hip and will eventually die, and that death will bring a lot of people together. The homeless man you mentioned as well, but certainly the two couples, the two brothers and some other folks too.
The homeless man, his name is Bob, mm-hmm. and so that creates confusion in his brain when he talks to Robert to know that he has the same name.
Right.
And of course, you go in by both Robert and Bob.
I do, although what that should not be taken as a kind of elbow in the ribs going, this is really about me. And on the contrary, back to the Graham Greene paraphrase, I went back after years of citing him and looked, and he says that in about 250 words, which I said in about 40. But the names then are not an indication that this is a biographical thing or an autobiographical thing. No elbow in the ribs here saying, you know, look, this is really about me. On the contrary, back to the Graham Greene thing, to the extent that anything that I put in the book that is there willfully because of it's being something that really happened to me, something I know from my own life, or something that is about me, to that extent, my process fails. It has to be the things that are forgotten that I work with. Now, that's not to say that when they reemerge from the compost heap from to my students called the place where we dream or the artistic unconscious or the white hot center. These are things I more commonly call them to my students, same as the compost heap. But the things that emerge from there, I might well, in retrospect, recognize them as, oh, well, that bit of composted material, I can recognize enough of its outline that it came from there if I wish to. But, you know, it's not a question I have. I chose Robert and Bob because for a deeper reason, in terms of wanting a formal version of the name for my university professor and an informal version of the name for the homeless man from a trailer park with a kind of abusive father of sorts, but his father was a Vietnam vet. Bob missed it by a decade or so, going to Vietnam. And Bob, the homeless man's relationship to his own father, who is a vet and who has secrets from his days in Vietnam, from the war. Bob's a kind of dark doppelganger to Robert, that Robert and his World War II veteran father, his father has secrets from the war, and Robert is keeping his own secrets. So I wanted the two men to share who they were, in a sense. And then I go back to the era in which Robert was named. And there are not a lot of choices with the nice formal version and then the informal version. There's William and Bill, but I'm a little too euphonic. And and William, that's the name of the father, and James and Jimmy, which Jimmy just a little bit too, I don't know, the valence is wrong on that for Bob. Either on the nose or ironically, either way, it's not right for the homeless guy. But Robert and Bob is a classic formal version, informal version. And if I were named Marmaduke, those characters would still be named Robert and Bob.
Bob Weber is the name of the homeless man. That's his full name. And his thought processes are still a little bit impaired. He's not quite mentally all together.
Right.
But then he suffers an assault. And it seems like that it even exacerbates it even more.
Yes, he does. Though ultimately the assault itself is not as central to what happens as it is to the way in which it moves these two men closer to encountering each other. Because ultimately, the book leads up to, as you know, an extended funeral home scene in which everyone, you know, the family comes together, as does Bob. But the fact that it was a nighttime unexpected act of violence that puts Bob into the emergency at just the right time to end up being put back into the care of the pastor at this church where he had sought refuge and where he was assaulted, and the way in which then fate brings all of that together what Bob is able to put his hands on then, without too many spoilers here, you know, at the pastorage office. All those things come together in a way that, again, is reflective, echoes into the ways in which the circumstances you're put into in the violence of war lead you to end up doing things or being the recipient of things that change your life. And that, what I just described, is true of Robert as well.
The structure of the book is unusual in a way that you don't have discrete chapters like we see so often in fiction. You have section breaks, but often even within sections, we change points of view and time mm-hmm. without any sense of segue in between. And so it's almost like just this free-form reminisce.
It is. You've read enough of my books to know that I'm enchanted with, and not just enchantment. It's not a separate enchantment. It's that in writing the vision of the human condition that I do, because that's how I see things, and the only way I know to express how I see things is to create these works of fiction, that I have traditionally, most of my books have been written in the first person, especially in the last 20, 25 years. This book isn't. It's in the third person, so that the inner access that we have, the flow of the past and the present together, is not through the narrow focus of the person experiencing it. It's through this omniscient narrator who's able to dip in and importantly in this book is be able to see the disconnect between the characters in terms of what they communicate to each other, how they understand each other, or even what they communicate and understand about themselves internally. There's often a disconnection. And that third-person narrator is able to see those things and articulate them, point them out to us as we move through. So, yeah, there's a lot of flow in and out of points of view and in perspectives and from present to past. I think it all stays clear and coherent as you move through, but it is a kind of dream state we're in. And the master of the dream is this unknown third-person narrator, of course.
Well, and when I was reading, I said, these psychological insights are so precise and so accurate that are these people having these insights themselves, or is it the narrator who is boiling everything down for us?
Sometimes it is themselves, but the narrator will point out that what he does not see, or this is going on underneath and is not aware of. I mean, the guide through there is very clear, but sometimes it's both, of course. And often what the third-person narrator lets us see is something that the character is kind of in a middle ground about, is clearly experiencing but not fully understanding or putting all the pieces together to see a larger picture that we are privy to at some point.
In the story, Darla, Robert's wife, she is a professor, a semiotician.
Yes.
And she is trying to do this herself, because she has a project where she's looking at monuments from the Daughters of the Confederacy, and she's trying to understand what all the implications, what are the signs and signifiers for these monuments.
Yeah, you put your finger on a good point. And it's true. She's doing what the narrator is doing for us and making connections or missing connections in just the ways that the characters are doing with each other. You know, for me, my aesthetic is in the way a work of literary art is able to present a coherent vision of the world is by that very thing, that patterning of things all begins to resonate into each other and to fit together, not in a didactic or explanatory or analytical way, but in that kind of essential moment-to-moment, sense-based way that you're describing there. That Civil War monument certainly sits in the center of her consciousness and echoes into the larger comments in the book, really, and I say comment, it's not an analytical comment, but the issues that the book cares about are, it's not just the Vietnam War here. William is a World War II veteran, and when we have access to his inner life, even as he's in a hospital dying, we move back to his relationship to his father in World War I, who was a veteran of World War I. The Civil War is present here in Robert's grandson, who seeks his advice at some point. We even look forward to the present holy wars of ISIS and American values. So all of it is fitting together.
it's just not fathers and sons and how their relationship with war act, because you do point out with Darla and her father that they had an argument about Vietnam when she was very young, mm-hmm. well, a teenager or in college, where they could have had a moment of connection, where the father could have expressed his admiration for his daughter, and it just slipped by.
Yeah. And again, the third-person narrator lets us see that, even though we're learning it within a memory that Darla has of that argument, and it's something that she totally missed. But that's where that omniscient, that all-seeing third-person narrator in the book is able to step back and let us see what she doesn't.
With all these characters, how do you go about gaining this insight into them? I mean, it seems like that would be a really big task.
It is too big a task to be done in the way that your question would naturally have me answer. In other words, this is where when I teach to my students, just the thing that relates to that Graham Greene compost heap, when I teach my creative writing students, as I must, it's something that has evaded virtually all of them. We give a PhD in creative writing. So many of my students have already MFAs from august institutions, and they know they all aspire to write literature, but they know the second through the tenth things about being an artist. They don't know the first thing about it, which is art does not come from the mind. It doesn't come from the rational analytical faculties. It doesn't come from ideas. It doesn't come from thoughtful, rational, psychological insight. It comes from the place where you dream, from your unconscious. And because no one is smart enough in an abstract, analytical way to be able to get at the things that art can. So I appreciate your observation about the book, and to whatever extent it succeeds in articulating, embedding, embodying, making incarnate these complex, multi-layered interactions of psychology and emotion and memory and present and fate and all of that. You know, how do you do that? Well, I don't do it. It happens through me. It is not a thing that I think about. You know, you go into that trance that you court for decades as you become and practice being a writer. And it's down in that deepest place in your unconscious, in your dream space, where all these things come together.
But how do you then in the revision and editing process not mess that up?
Well, that's a good question. The thing I just said about how art is created is from the unconscious. There is a corollary for readers. You are not meant, as a reader of literary fiction, you are not meant to understand it when you read in an analytical, theoretical, philosophical, thematic, symbolic, ideological way. None of the ways that you've learned to think and talk about literature in literature classes, all of that's bogus in terms of the creation of the work and in terms of the primary and only necessary encounter of the reader with the work of literary art. You are meant to thrum to a work of art as you read, like the vibration on a stringed instrument. It's a thrumming process.
To resonate with art.
To resonate, exactly. And we go back to the Graham Greene notion that the thrumming process gives you access to your dream space. The reader brings her own dream space into correspondence with the waking dream of this created narrative. And that's where understanding takes place in this non-analytical way. So we also go back to Graham Greene for the good novelist, bad memory notion. In answer to your question, the way you edit without messing it up, what you don't do is what happens in writers' workshops, which is you read the thing and then you bring your analytical powers and all the craft and technique you know to bear on problems that seem to be there that you then find solutions for technically, and you willfully then construct those to fix it. On the contrary, what you do is you let your good novelist bad memory assert itself. You let the work cool off sufficiently that when you go back and read your own work, you can do so to some great degree as if you hadn't written it. You know, it's not total amnesia, obviously, but you forget just enough of it that you don't know how it felt right when you wrote it wrong. So you end up going back and you go you start reading and you go thrum, 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 twang. And when you hit the twang, you do not now think. What you do is you go back to the twangy part and you redream it. You go back into the dream space, into your unconscious, and re-engage there in the way what's probably happened. The reason it's wrong is that you slipped out of that to begin with. Those two wrongs certainly don't make a right. You don't then stay out and analyze. You go back in and redream. So rewriting is redreaming.
But could it not be like a sense where Thelonious Monk played the piano? Some people would say that was the wrong note. Maybe that twang is the spark of something else.
It could well be. I mean, oftentimes the twang will lead you in the redream fix to make it even better than it could have been if it had been right the first time, which I think is probably the monk analogy. Or if the monk notes that sound off that he keeps, then those are no longer twangs anyway. Those are thrums. And so in your rereading, if you're really rereading properly, then it won't really sound like a twang to you. The musicians call it a rub. A rub is not a twang. The rub is where there's certain expectations that are going, and then you change them. You change the key. You surprise with this kind of a chord, or you move in a different way harmonically that is against the grain or somehow. But if you're doing your job properly, you will hear that as still as a thrum, but as a thrum of a different sort. But either way, the process of rewriting is the same. You either recognize it for what it really is. Analytically, it might sound like a twang, but you hear the deeper thrum in it, or it is a twang, but in redreaming it, because the twang was there, your redreaming opens something up to you that you wouldn't have gotten at if the thing had just flowed in its own natural way the first time.
Is there a difference in this state when it comes to character and plot? Because your previous three novels were historical thrillers, the Christopher Marlowe Cobb stories, which are much more plot-driven. You have to have more of like a logical progress to get to the action, as opposed to Perfume River, which is more character-driven.
Absolutely. But the Cobb stuff are still literary in that the overt elements of historical espionage thriller that are there not because I'm just trying to produce an effect willfully, but they're coming out of and through the character who's at the center of my waking dream of creating. And honestly, those books are embedding and embodying certain things that I see about the human condition, about our current zeitgeist. There's so much in the Cobb books that echo into our present, as it was true 100 years ago through the First World War. The issues from genocide to American imperialism to other imperialism to war in its barbaric improvisation, there's so much in the early 20th century that is a reflection upon what's crazily happening in our world today. And the kinds of plot necessities, they're not necessities. They are reflections of major cause and effect issues that you will see every night on CNN or MSNBC or Fox News. You see those things in action in the world. As you know, I've always embraced what seem to be genre fiction elements. Mr. Spaceman, one of my novels, is written in the voice of a spaceman in a spaceship who's just kidnapped a busload of gamblers heading for casinos in Lake Charles from Houston. And hell is a fantasy. It's entirely in hell. A small hotel, I think it was the last time we talked. Oprah Magazine made it a book of the week, called it a new old-fashioned romance. I am open to the presence of those larger genre cultural elements of fiction if they are the right ones to create the object that I'm trying to create, to articulate or even to explore. I don't even know what I think about the world until I write it, to explore my sense of the human condition as it exists in the first quarter of the 21st century.
Do you think the research for the Cobb books led you to make Robert Quinlan a historian who studied the anti-war movement of the early 20th century?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I tell you what it did do as well. I mean, this I was aware of. I'm going to have to think about that because I think you're right. But I can tell you as well that writing those three Cobb books in the 3 years, I love and stand by those books as their own objects. But those 3 years were also a workout in the gym for me, working on certain muscle groups that I had, but hadn't maybe developed as much. You know, I bulked up in certain muscles, writing those books and nuanced them. So that when I got to Perfume River, the best of the pre-publication review outlets, I think, is Book List from the American Library Association. They gave a starred review to Perfume River. The reviewer referred to the backbeat of suspense in Perfume River. And absolutely there is. And I think it makes this book a lot stronger in a very organic way, given the backgrounds of these people and, you know, that essence of war that it pervades the book. I don't think that would have been as strong or as good if I hadn't written those three Cobb books just before this one. And in fact, I am halfway through. I took a pause from a two-book contract for Otto Penzler, my wonderful editor at Mysterious Press, which is the imprint inside Grove Atlantic, my Uber publisher, who does my Cobb books. I took a break in a two-book contract to write Perfume River for Morgan Entrick and my publisher, Grove. And when I finished Perfume River, I went back to that second book I owed on the second two-book contract to Otto. And I'm halfway through that book now. It's called Paris in the Dark. And I'm finding that that book now is being influenced by, in a kind of very subtle way, by Perfume River. That certain muscle groups that I've flexed in Perfume River are being used in Paris in the Dark in ways that I hadn't necessarily expected. So there's an ongoing dialogue in me, you know, within all the books I'm writing.
Our narrator, who's interpreting all these psychological states of our characters, there's one character that the narrator doesn't seem to have quite as deep access to, and that's Peggy, who is Robert's mother, his father's wife. And she seems to be kind of the person that's not worried about a truth coming back. She has these convenient lies she's telling herself to make it through this very terrible time. And we just don't have quite the same access as to her as the others.
No, although we do ultimately. We do see her in her relationship to William. When he is gone, we finally have access to her, as you recall. She remembers him on their wedding, when they were married, on their wedding night, when she was waiting for him to come back from Europe after the World War was over.
Her concerns after his retirement.
Her concerns after his retirement. I mean, but interestingly, we don't have access to her till he's dead. And I hadn't thought of it this way at all. And this is all kind of the kind of lit crit talk that's mistake for prior intention. But in retrospect, yeah, it's ironic because her dynamic is to submit and submerge herself into keeping the family together and keeping them on track and so forth, keeping the marriage and the family together.
But she has her own passive-aggressive machinations
in
order to
achieve
that.
But she has her own machinations where it's really controlling the family and trying to shape it in the image that she has of it, which is her own image. So we don't see her true self until her husband's dead, because that's, in a way, that's the psychological choice she has made. Though we do see through her, we don't see inside her, but we see through her all along in some ways. But finally, when he's gone, we see inside her. So you can make what you want of that. But yes, we do. But it's deferred until he's dead.
Did you have any idea whatsoever what was inside her until that happened?
No, not at all. What was inside her was making her act in a coherent and complex but consistent way. So I must have known, but I didn't know any of the details of it until he was dead.
In writing believable characters, you know, we have to have some level of consistency in how their actions and their motivations are, but also we're full of contradictions being humans. How do you balance out?
We're consistently contradictory at times, too.
Yeah. So how do you balance behaving consistently, then the contradictions in there that do make them complex?
Well, go back to the musical phrase, the rub. When they contradict themselves, the rub is always a sense of, whoa, I'm in a different direction in this piece of music. And yet experiencing the rub of it, nevertheless, that implies two things in contact. And so it's in that way that the contradictions of personality happen. That, yes, they double back on themselves, or the point at which, and we all carry around contradictions in ourselves, and the point where our contradiction asserts itself, we have enough evidence of them to understand that that is a consistent contradiction, that it is psychologically not only plausible, but even revealing to see that that's been going on underneath.
How do you account for your ability to produce? Because I've interviewed a lot of first-time authors over the years that have taken 10 years to get that first novel out, and then maybe 5 years for the second one. But you consistently put out quality work at such an amazing rate.
Well, thank you. I've recently had occasion to count them. I've done 23 books in the last 35 years. Discipline, for one thing, writing every day. My unconscious keeps yielding up books to write. It's a kind of mystery in that respect. It's not like I can, just because I go write every day doesn't mean I have to write every day to maintain my connection to my unconscious. Write every day during the space of, you know, when I'm working on a book. But I've got a really good bad memory. And I think, and I've lived a very eclectic, broad, you know, experienced life. And I've lived it very intensely. Artists aren't intellectuals. We're sensualists, and we're ravaged by the human experience in daily life. So I've done a lot of things, known a lot of people, experienced a lot, been a lot of places, and I've forgotten it all. And so it seems the compost heap in me has plenty of material still. I don't feel like there's any end to it.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been too long, but it was so much fun.
I am so glad to see you again. It's been a delight. Thank you so much. You always ask fabulous questions.
Robert Olin Butler is the author of Perfume River, which is published by Grove Atlantic. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.